Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
His typical day as a writer, he says he tries to write 8 hours a day. He wakes up, has his breakfast, reads his paper, reads a book on poetry, nerd, particularly English. Listen to this. He's every woman's and mine dream. He says this. So first off, if you see, here's a picture of Pierce Brown. If you haven't noticed already, he's a gorgeous man. But he says, I read a book of poetry, particularly English romantics, because they have such a felicity of phrase and expression, and it really opens up my use of words. You perfect... Shut up. It's just... You know what you're doing, Pierce Brown. Welcome back, everybody, to another Two to Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
And I'm the other less enthused host,
how
Richard.
I kid.
I'm a big fan of Pierce Brown. I love his books.
We saw him in person. This is an author deep dive on Pierce Brown. We've done this twice before with Brandon Sanderson, J.R.R. Tolkien. It's where we go over the life, the works, the inspirations. Who was Pierce Brown influenced by? What's going on with adaptations? What books has he written? What's he going to do in the future? Just all about his life and getting really personal and detailed. Things that you probably didn't want to know, Rich.
Probably, but I now know them anyway.
Now, I want you to best describe him. Who is Pierce Brown? What is he known for, Rich?
He's known for looking like a stud and writing some pretty kick-ass books.
Couldn't say it better myself. He wrote the Red Rising series. He got Red Rising. Golden Sun, Morning Star, and then the sequel series in the same saga, where you have Iron Gold, Dark Age, Lightbringer, and then Red God to come. And this is his only series so far, but we'll get into what he's doing after. I just kind of want to start with his early life and what made this man who he came to be.
Is this why you've been changing up your morning routine?
I've been trying to emulate.
You started acting really differently. I was wondering something.
Pierce Brown is my spirit animal, and this what he does is law, is scripture.
Of course.
And so he was born in 1988. I can't fix when I was born, so I can't be exactly like him. I'm 10 years too late. I hurt myself every morning going, damn.
You might as well not even try.
I know. It's January 28th, if you're wondering.
Hey, it's close to my birthday.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Oh, you're closer to him than I am.
I am. Ha-ha.
So his early life and what led him to being this author that he is today, he actually moved around 7 times before he turned 18. So his family's always moving around all the places around the country. He went to more than 10 schools, and friends were more interchangeable and temporary. The longest friendship he had really lasted 4 years, or at least the longest in-person physical friend lasted 4 years.
We're coming up on our deadline, man.
We're past 4 years. I know it's...
Are we?
Yeah.
Oh, how long have we been friends? So
the time's been gone fast because we've had fun. That's what you're saying.
That's one way to put it.
We've been like 6 or 7 years, Rich.
The other way to take it is so much of the time is just dead in my mind.
You forget all of it.
I forget most of it.
Can you be positive?
There's a solid year and a half of friendship in the memory of 7 years.
when was that? Please tell me.
I don't know. I forgot you were my roommate for a solid 6 months.
This is a real story. We still talk about this. 2019.
Yeah.
It was a summer. 3 months we were roommates.
And I completely forgot that he was a roommate of mine. I had so many roommates just coming in, like just friends that need a place, and then they were in mine.
I mean this sincerely. Mm-hmm. It was the most hurtful thing you've ever said. I was devastated. I'm like, you don't remember anything? Remember when we did the thing? And you went, no, no, I don't. It's like, wow, I'm that unfun.
At that time, yes, you were. To be fair, circumstances being, you had a busy, hectic schedule. But
still,
I just know that I had dinner by myself, and then when I went into the bathroom, there's no second toothbrush. So What am I supposed to do?
Where's
think?
Austin gone again?
Where is he? He's somewhere, I assume.
So Pierce Brown's longest friendships lasted really 4 years or so. And I have a little theory about this with Pierce Brown. Do you think that because he moved around all the time and didn't have that deep connection with childhood friends, that's why he can kill off characters so easily? You think that's... I'm trying to psychoanalyze Pierce Brown going...
Trying to psychoanalyze
think
it?
About it. Just like characters, they come and go. If he's been writing this character for 4 years, who cares? I'm moving on. I'm moving to the next book. I'm moving to the next town. Pierce doesn't care. That's what I think.
That's an emotional detachment. I think the main thing is he has a healthy attachment to his works. There's a lot of authors there that, like, they get too sucked into their own world, of they're too invested in their own characters that they're not willing to take risks with them and kill them off.
Kill their darlings.
Yeah. Pierce Brown has a healthy connection to his writings where he's willing to craft this wonderful character and then just murder him at an impromptu time. Like, oh, there's so much I could do with him, but no, I'm going to kill him early. That's because he's healthy.
Do you think it's healthy when he does this? He has a hat. He's done this in the past. He has a hat and he puts a bunch of names in there, takes one out and kills that character.
Oh, it's genius. It's lovely. Yeah. I absolutely love it.
It's the just chaos. The right amount of chaos and turmoil for Rich. Actually, he named one of his childhood friends in those little stints. Not named them. He was inspired to write Severo because of one of his childhood friends.
I don't know if I'd ever want to meet him.
The quick story is that this childhood friend of Pierce Brown, he helped him in a fight and started biting the other guy. He said, "That's Severo." So, and then the rest is history. But his inkling as a kid, this is the last part of his early life, because there's not, you know, I don't have the, okay, let's be honest, I did search as much as I could.
You did stalk him a little bit on the internet, a little bit in person, but hey, you know.
The reason we're posting this online is because he didn't accept my calls.
Maybe, if you want, send this over to Pierce Brown. Maybe he'll give us a ring back.
Actually, please. Send this video. Just let him know Tudor Ramble wants to interview Pierce Brown, talk with him, have coffee. So this is the snippet of his early childhood where he got that inkling of wanting to be a writer. This is what he said in quotes. "Storytelling has always been a peculiar and significant source of magic in my life. It was the stories from my grandfather I remembered best. I'd sit for hours listening as he talked and smoked unfiltered Camel cigarettes on the patio. Eternally grumpy or joyous, never in between, he told tales with madcap passion. Each was taller than the next. They were absurd, truly, irrevocably absurd, full of tricksters and backwater bandits and clever outsiders and logical gaps as wide as the Mississippi. It made him a giant, his grandfather, and this keeper of some great hoard of knowledge, and it set him into the magic of storytelling." So his grandfather really helped him, inspired him as a kid to really want to do this, but he didn't actually start writing. You know what, Rich, since you did, you don't know much about Pierce Brown, I'm assuming, right?
I don't know the most.
I want you to guess, okay? We'll play a little guessing game. When he started actually writing.
Actually writing?
Yes.
What do we mean by actually write? Like actually writing Red Rising or writing just in general?
Writing his first book.
17.
Close enough. 18. You're pretty damn accurate.
I was giving him too much credit.
Yeah. He in college, he just finished high school and turned 18. And this is when he got this spirit and wanted to go write a book. During this time, he went to Pepperdine University. He was an undergrad degree in political science and economics. He actually lived with his political science professor for a stint, like for a semester or something, because he needed a place to stay. That's how close he was with his professors, which, little snippet into my life, I've never been that close with a professor. I don't know about you, but to me, I'd never in school, maybe that says something about me. I was just never had that teacher everybody else has that goes, that one inspired me the most. I wish I had that.
The closest I ever came was I TA'd for a professor. That was it. Like, I was pretty good at...
What was the professor's name? That's why I'm asking. I knew.
It's Professor Davies, actually.
Oh, I do remember. Oh, okay,
I'm terrible with names. I actually remember his name. That's a good sign.
That is.
But no, he was a Western legal tradition, which was just Western philosophy class. And I was pretty good at it, so I TA'd that.
Yeah. But Pierce Brown was close enough with his professor, and he has had some jobs in politics where he was a personal driver for a senator, and that's where he got some insights into politics and where you see the politics in Red Rising and how that plays out. After college, he actually worked for The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, which...
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a weird...
Yeah.
That's a weird transition.
He was a NBC page.
Oh, okay.
Like, he was a page. He wasn't on there being like, hey, Jay, how you doing?
I was wondering if he was, like, writing. He is not writing the show.
He's... No. He was purely a page.
The bottom totem pole.
Yeah.
The whipping boy.
He was, like, 20, you know, 20, 21. So, but of course, this stuff wasn't his dream. He was doing this in the meantime. While all that was going on, he was writing. And he wrote his first, started writing his first book when he was 18 years old, okay? And this is a quote from Pierce Brown again. He said, I had finished a feast for crows in high school and was waiting for A Dance of Dragons to come out. This is Game of Thrones, or Song of Ice and Fire. One night, I sat down with a yellow legal pad and started writing the scene and these mercenaries trying to capture a dragon to harvest its eggs. After 25 pages, I wondered if I should put this into a world and write a book. 800 pages later, I had a monstrous tome called Requiem for Light. This is his first book. Unpublished, did not get picked up by agents, but it's called Requiem for Light. It was overblown, but very cool. It's funny, though. I had a slave miner like Darrow in Red Rising, and there were pit vipers. There were these superhumans who have maintained peace in the area of land until one of their founders returns and exposes the hypocrisy of their orders and their ranks. But it was a multi-point of view story, and it was a lot of fun to write, and he ended up writing like a maniac and finishing like 15 pages a day. He says, retroactively, it makes sense that I ended up being a writer when he looks back at this. So, what...
Him looking back at him writing an 800-page book goes, yeah, I'm... Looking back at that moment in my life, I would say I'm probably going to be a writer.
It's weird because this gave me the inkling of... I got to mention Sanderson every video, so I think this is my second time now. But you know how he, in his first unpublished book that didn't get picked up by agents, called Requiem for Light, he had a slave miner and he had pit vipers, these inklings of characters. Just like Sanderson, you could tell with different books, you have inklings of the other characters in other books that Sanderson's written.
Oh, yeah.
For example, Shallan and...
And I forget her the character's name, but in... Oh, shoot. Name of the book, Elantris. The female POV in Elantris has a lot of similar characteristics with Shallan. I would say probably like... Maybe part Shallan, part Jesna. Or Yesna.
Yesna, yeah.
I like a 50-50 split type deal.
Okay. Because you see these influences or you see these foundations. You think an author just comes out and just writes a good book out of nowhere.
No.
99% of cases, no. Then your 1% of cases, like, who are those people? I think Great Gatsby, was that a one and done?
I believe so.
Scarlet Letter,
I'm not sure. But I do know
To Kill a Mockingbird.
It's the one and done.
Yeah. And they just nailed it, left.
I refuse to acknowledge that the second book exists because that was stolen by the...
There's a second book?
Yeah, there was a second book after she died. The lawyer basically allegedly swindled the author to basically, while under duress or like while she was loopy, she's not all there, signed over the rights to this unreleased book that she wrote. This was the book she wrote before To Kill a Mockingbird, the one that was denied. Everyone's asked her for the book. She said, no, it's terrible. It tarnishes the legacy of To Kill a Mockingbird. I don't want it released. So as soon as she dies, lawyer releases the book.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not.
This is a real story?
Yeah.
Oh, what an asshole.
I know. It's terrible.
Wow.
And I refuse to read it for that exact reason.
Yeah.
And... Like, is it good? Like, it wasn't... I'm sure it's probably better than a lot of works today, but it just feels dirty.
The author didn't want it released. So respect the author's wishes.
Now, legally speaking, the lawyer has papers that says that she's okay with it being released.
Oh.
But all through her life...
She was saying no.
She said no.
Yeah.
She apparently only said yes on her deathbed.
Oh, that's a bit sketchy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Please don't do that on my deathbed. Because we know I'm dying first.
I'm releasing the Discord. I'm releasing the group chat memes on your deathbed.
My reputation that's already not there.
It's gonna tarnish it.
I've never seen someone with already a poor reputation get worse. It's so...
Oh, yeah.
It's incredible. But how do you think I'll die before you? What's your theory?
Oh, I don't want to ruin the surprise.
So Pierce Brown wrote this massive 800-page book as his first book ever, Reckoning for Light. Now, in that five-year period from about 18 to 23, mm-hmm. so he's a college kid and just getting out of college, we're older than he was when he became a success. Well, how do you feel about that?
Oh, I feel just about as good as you, buddy.
So he wrote, in 5 years, wrote six books, not including Red Rising. So he wrote six books, and each and every one of them was rejected by over 120 agents. I think it was approaching 130. I think it was the 129 agents rejected him.
Eesh.
That's... No, that's
what it takes, though. Here's the thing. Failure is not a loss. It's just experience. Yeah. And he clearly picked up on the right lessons of, okay, I learned something on this book. Time to try again.
Yeah.
And eventually it led to a success. But it's odd to think about when people get one piece of rejection and then never try again. Oh, well. That's a wrap with my writing career.
Right. It's like 18. I got it all figured out. This 800-page epic. Of course it's going to be the best book ever.
Yeah.
Okay. So Pierce Brown said about all these rejections, he said, he was getting rejected, in quotes, probably because I didn't write the right book. I was learning the craft, as you're saying, Rich. I didn't study writing in writing school. Rejection was my motivation, and failure is what taught me. With that, he said, hey, if I got rejected on this next book, Red Rising, that there's a great chance he would have given up. Because seven books rejected in a row, what is your stopping point? You're either proven insane or you're proven a success. What's that quote about insanity? It's just
doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result.
Except in this case, you're writing a different book and improving, of course. But how many books do you write? What's the number before you go, I'm just not a good writer, or it'll take too long. And for Pierce Brown, that might have been that seventh book, but fortunately for him, it was Red Rising, and it got picked up. It was a smash hit. But what do you think is the line? Is it different for people? Or how would you come to terms with that if you're really passionate about something, but your passion doesn't align with something that you're good at?
Oof. That's most of my passions. The things I'm good at, I'm not particularly passionate about.
Man.
That's the weird thing.
Yeah.
Like, I have some talent in singing. I've always been pretty good at it, and I just never put effort into it. Just never have. Where I like the saxophone, and I'm just not good at it. So it's like, it's these weird things.
Oh my God.
Could have picked a choice. Like, I could have picked the easier route, but I didn't.
Your life makes so much more sense now. You're passionate about the things you're bad at.
Yeah.
And then amazing at the things you could give a shit about.
That's about it. Yeah.
I never realized in all of our years of friendship.
By the way,
it's 8 years now. I was looking back.
It's
8 years of friendship. I did the math.
Yeah, we got two more years left. A decade's long enough.
A decade's a long time to know
somebody.
A decade's
too long.
Oh, God.
I want new people. But no, I always wanted to be always wanted to be like a lawyer, wanted to do things, go into politics, wanted to do things with words.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not particularly good at words. I'm decent at math.
Can I lift you up for a second?
I was doing all that stuff, and then I just didn't pursue that.
I'm going to lift you up, okay? Because mm-hmm. we can joke, but you in the past, look at this channel. We did this, I think last week we looked at this. A video we did a year ago,
mm-hmm.
and you could listen to both of our voices in that video, and it was excruciating. Do you remember watching yourself?
Yeah. It was terrible.
So I think you've gotten a lot better with words. That's just me.
I've gotten better at saying words, not particularly writing them.
Okay.
The book is going to be difficult because I'm a very curt writer. So during different writing classes in college, I'm always used to I would always do maybe half of the required word count. I'd still get a B+ or an A because the professor would say well, you covered every single point that needed to be covered and you cited your evidence and everything's here. You just didn't do the word count. I'm like, yeah, I followed exactly what you asked. I gave you exactly what you wanted.
Except the page count.
Except the page count.
What you gonna do?
I'm efficient writer. I don't like...
That's why you don't like your fluff.
I don't particularly like the fluff. That's why I love those short books.
You're Terry Pratchett.
my Terry Pratchett's is just it's wonderful.
Yeah.
But with Pierce Brown, seven old books and just writing that. That kind of dedication is impressive to me.
Yeah, because where do you draw the line?
Well, think about it this way. I think we are going to run into almost an opposite problem. Eventually, with writing.
Okay,
we're eventually going to have our books done and written, and we're going to try and release it. Pierce Brown got to go through the actual forging experience of getting his books rejected. Meaning he's has to go out to a publisher and he has to change, and it forces him to grow and learn.
Yeah.
Us with our platform, like, we're going to see some amount of success since we've already built a platform.
So our gobbledygook,
will get some success. It won't, like, if it's bad, it's still not going to be great, but we always have the option of just self-publishing because we have the platform where we don't have to risk that with, like, Pierce Brown just had to
finding a publisher where you can self-publish now.
Exactly.
I see what you mean.
So I think our writing could potentially suffer because we don't have to go through the same stuff that Pierce Brown did.
Unless an actual publisher picks it up.
Yeah.
That's cool. Different story. But with Red Rising, that's what a big deal was, that this type of story that Pierce Brown was saying, that nobody was accepted. Here's a quote from him. He was saying people weren't buying space operas at the time, but people were buying YA-style novels. So Red Rising was this kind of Trojan horse where he wasn't writing the right book for the time, and he decided to pivot. He wanted to make it as a writer, and that's why he wrote Red Rising, among the other influences. But that sums up pretty much Pierce Brown's early life going to Red Rising. If you don't mind, I want to transition now into his influences and inspirations of as a writer and for Red Rising itself.
Of course.
Now, he was asked, which authors, Pierce Brown, are you most inspired by? And Pierce Brown gave 10. These are from two different interviews, but he has 10 people who he was most inspired by as an author. Mm-hmm. Gene Wolfe, who wrote Book of the New Sun, he said Gene Wolfe is a master of fantasy and prose. Secondly, Neil Gaiman, one of the best mood/world builders that Pierce Brown has ever read. Thirdly, J.K. Rowling, who taught him so many things, and she ushered in a new age of fantasy culture being accepted by mainstream technology, much in the same way Tolkien did. That's what he's saying. And then fourth, I've never heard of this author. I've known the books he's written, though. Robert Heinlein, who wrote Stranger in Strange Land. And he's the man who perfected science fiction as a social commentary, Pierce Brown says. And fifth, Stephen King, who is wonderful, but because Pierce Brown realizes that, although he's not entranced by his stories, he just can't write like him, and he has nowhere near the patience to write the way Stephen King does, so he was inspired in that way. And then sixth, Bernard Cornwell, who is his favorite writer of historical fiction, which we are not much into historical fiction.
Not really, but
one day. Pierce Brown, history is a big part of him, because then the seventh person he's inspired by, he has Homer, eighth, Sophocles, and then ninth and tenth are George R. R. Martin and J.R.R. Tolkien, and for obvious reasons, epic fantasy modern for George R. R. Martin, and the epic fantasy that began everything with Middle-earth and Tolkien.
I think you can really see the Homer influence in the second half of the Red Rising saga series, and I think the references are fairly apparent.
Yeah, you can tell he's a Roman/Greek history nerd.
Oh no, I'm thinking specifically Darrow.
Oh, yeah,
like Darrow going on kind of like a Homer's journey.
Yeah, this is what I mean. Pierce Brown has read the Iliad, read all these stories, and goes, okay, this is the experience he has as a writer. Because another thing for first time writers, and Red Rising being his big success, do you find it true that typically you take a part of yourself or something you know? Because if you're so young, he's 22 years old writing Red Rising, you have to grasp what you know and be able to write from that. How is a 22-year-old Pierce Brown going to write about the struggles of motherhood and combating with the justice of Southeastern Korea? Like, not South Korea, Southeast South Korea.
Oh, yeah, no.
The specific town he's never been to. You just can't write a story like that until you have more life experience or you research it enough and just a bunch. So do you find that's true?
Oh, definitely. You can write about the settings. Like, you could do all the research you want, but especially when it comes to character motivations, I think you do have to have a lot of experience, and either personal experience or experience with immediate family members. So if you've lived a long life and you are in contact with, so like if you're married and you've been married to your wife for 10 years, I would imagine at some point you'd pick up a little bit on what it's like to be a woman, more so than the 18, 20-year-old guy. Probably doesn't understand it nearly as much. Right. I'm just making an assumption here. So
it's not a coincidence that the best female character I've ever read is by Emma Wang. It's not a coincidence.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know, it's very much a stereotype in fantasy sci-fi that comes out to be true, that a lot of female characters sometimes aren't written as well. Depending on the author, there's some amazing ones.
I'm not scratching everybody, but
a sci-fi author typically isn't known for writing the most compelling female characters.
Yeah, I've heard, I think, personally, terrible advice for men writing female characters. I've heard this said as, like, good advice. If you're going to write a female character, do what you're, like, create the character, create the male character, think all that stuff, and then just make it female. And to me, I think that's terrible advice that's not exactly what it is. Like, there is a unique perspective that women go through that you do kind of have to know about, because it shapes the character's motivations, how the character interacts with the rest of the world. It's not a one-to-one.
You're right. Here's a really small example of a female or a male, I'd assume, would go outside at dark with different mental frameworks and
sure.
different precautions and different worry. And that changes your life and worldview. And yeah, exactly that, because you can't just go, oh, just replace this and replace the gender and then everything's the same.
No, the gender differences actually do matter in a story.
And you know, that writing advice, I haven't heard that much.
I've heard it a lot.
You have heard that a lot?
Yeah.
Okay.
To me, it just seems like poor advice. That you actually just need, the better advice is to talk to the women in your life and get their perspective and ask them questions and talk to them about the character and like, hey, what would if you were in this character's position, what would you do? That's probably better advice than just making it, you know, just the gender swap. Right. It doesn't really work as well.
Yeah, especially if you have a young author who doesn't know much, and then like Pierce Brown was in this situation. Yeah. So
I think best if you're, now there's a difference between your main character and your side characters. I think like if you're not inside their head, you could probably write some great side female characters. Yeah. If you're really young and inexperienced, probably fine. It's just if you're an 18-year-old guy and you're like, I'm going to write my first book and it's going to be a female main character.
Well, we're not saying it can't be done. Exceptions exceptions. But for example, Pierce Brown, here's the way I'm thinking about it with, you know, writing different characters. Because again, Sanderson writes amazing female characters, and you have an author doesn't have to have a certain mental illness to write that mental illness. So this isn't a one for one. It's life experience. There's a lot of things to it. But for example, with Pierce Brown being so young and a male author, he wrote Io in a way that Darrow viewed Io. Think about it there, where he didn't write Io from the perspective of like, okay, it's not that he was writing her out the way that Io thought of herself. You know, he was looking at the view of Pierce Brown was a guy who'd experienced love, I'm sure, and was looking at her like he probably has experienced love in his life. So having that allowed him to create a great female character that drove Darrow's character, and that's what was good about it, because Pierce Brown had that perspective.
Well, it's also great in later books of Darrow actually looking back on Io, going, my view of her in book one and other books was that my opinion has now shifted.
Yes.
Like my opinion was not 100% clear at the time.
And coincidentally, Pierce Brown got older.
Yeah.
As he's writing these books and he's looking back and he's getting feedback and he's starting to understand more about life, and maybe that's why that shifted. Mm-hmm. So just showing that an author's actual life obviously can reflect in your first book especially, and then all the subsequent books.
Yeah, I just think it's important. It's not a hard law. Like, of course you can.
It's just interesting
your first book and you're young. It's like, try something you know, with your first one, try something that you intimately understand and know.
It's like going out and running for the first time and going, I'm going for a marathon. It's like, well,
hold, you could
slow
but.
Down, slow down. Are you, have you ran one? No. Okay. So at least how about you first look what shoes you need? All right. Know the tools, then practice a little bit, write a little bit, knowing the things, you know, like, oh, I can do 10 minute miles. Anyways. No. So Pierce Brown, this is how he came up with the idea for Red Rising. So it was really organic, he says. He was hiking in the Cascade Mountain Range, and he'd been rereading the Greek play Antigone. So, big fan of the classics. And he was struck by the contrast of the story in Antigone, where the dichotomy of the forces represented. There was this young, disenfranchised girl who stands up to cold power. And he thought, what a beautiful thing it was that such a fragile character could be the seed of destruction. And then he wondered, what did Antigone leave behind? What if there was a person who was in love with Antigone? How could her actions transform not only him, but the world? And the story started to unravel before him. So for as we're talking about this whole female male character thing, the first character in his mind was Io. Io being the driving force for Darrow. And she was the first character, and it was always about that sacrifice, an Io sacrifice that drove Darrow's character and drove the whole story. And she was conceived far before Darrow.
That's interesting to think about.
Yeah.
That Io, the effectively fridged, fridged female love interest, was the first character he thought about.
Right. And he was, again, from his perspective, he'd read Antigone, and I'm sure he knows love, so he could write this character to drive the motivation. And there you go. That's how part of the reason why Red Rising spawned. And here's the second part as well. So he also says, when he was on this mountain climb as well on the Cascades in Washington State, it was at night in the snow, and the terrain there looked like one of the settings in Red Rising, that there were no lights and stars so close you could reach out and grab them. And he started writing the next day. So he had this Mars feel when he was out on this endless snow and just went, you know, looking up at the stars, and came to him then.
What you're telling me is we got to go on more hikes.
Yeah. I'm always down for hikes.
Oh, I'd love to.
Hikes are nice.
Unfortunately, we record on weekends.
Yeah. But to find that inspiration for a story, I'm sure Pierce Brown has had his first six that he wrote and that didn't go anywhere. He probably had similar stories where he just used the setting around him, came up with an idea, and went with it. Because as we'll get into a little bit later about his writing style, he's a pantser, not a plotter. Well, I'll touch on that later, because I do want to also address, he was asked the question, in the Red Rising Society, there's a hierarchy of color-coded castes with reds at the bottom, golds at the top. And this interview asked him, how does this system come about? Where'd you get this idea from? We're seeing, like, how did Red Rising spawn? So he got this idea over there. He read Antigone. He had this life experience. So how did he come up with the color system? And this was the answer. Well, the origin here is Plato's Republic. So he has a lot of inspirations from the classics. So in Plato's Republic, Pierce Brown says that Plato says in the Plato's Republic that in a perfect society, men should form a natural hierarchy. There are men with souls of gold and men with souls of copper, iron. The one with iron should till the soil, while the ones of gold should rule the city. But he didn't believe it should pass down through birth. He believed in meritocracy. So Plato's opinion is meritocracy, but there's hierarchy in this meritocracy. Now, Pierce Brown's problem is that Plato didn't consider, or at least he wasn't going with this thought experiment, that people would accumulate wealth and power, and that naturally they would pass it down to those they love, being a human. So he thought it would be interesting. We have a meritocracy, but how could that meritocracy be poisoned? And that's where the color system came about, a poisoned meritocracy.
I did know that it was based on Plato's Republic, but I haven't really thought about how it relate to ours, that how we do have a hierarchy, a meritocracy-based system of how it would be poisoned. How do you think that the color system actually kind of reflects our own meritocracy system?
Actually, so Pierce Brown was saying that he, again, being 20 at the time, even though he was in politics, he says that he wanted to not reflect as much as possible, that you could take what you want from it, but he's not trying to, He's not trying to make
He's not
direct,
making an allegory.
He's not making an allegory. He's not making a Narnia or C.S. Lewis. I think, you know what, Rich, I'm going to say this. I think C.S. Lewis is religious.
You think so?
I got a hint. There was something about this lion and something about this witch and this little closet they call the wardrobe. And then I'm just putting two together.
I'm just thinking Aslan, you know, for some reason, I just imagine Aslan on like just T-posing for some reason. That's what I'm picturing.
Right. Now, Tolkien, who's also Catholic and very religious, you can see the messages as well, but it was just less symbolic and less...
Oh, no. The deeper meanings are influenced by his faith.
Yeah,
but it's
course.
Not, you know, Frodo is not Jesus. Neither is Gandalf. Like, there are no Jesus
Actually,
direct
Frodo's
allegories.
Probably the opposite in many ways of Fels.
Yeah. So it's very much a different type of story.
Definitely. Definitely. Now, did I address the question? Do we even care? Just want me to move on?
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
The fact that the color system of Red Rising does not relate to ours, I was thinking about the poisoning of a meritocracy system of where it starts on with good intentions, but then of course meritocracy breaks down.
Right.
Of, you know, you give the wealth to the ones you love, and the ones you love are not really deserving of it because they didn't actually get to that position in the first place.
Yeah, and in fact, sometimes they're worse off because if you live that privilege of a life growing up, it's harder to build character, which again is why in this Red Rising series, and the very start from Red Rising book one, is the decadence of society and people just going with emotions and being in, and golds. Golds have it all, so they had to input something to harden you. That was the entire basis of trying to throw in this meritocracy and still make the privileged kids earn it.
Yeah, it's one of the things from the first book that I took that is some. It's a positive that we should take into our own lives of if we consider, historically speaking, people in the United States and most of the rest of the world, we are all the golds of history. Like, we live such privileged lives and so soft. We face no hardship in comparison to, you know, generations past.
What, not like even if you live,
no, even our wars are not the same. Like, it's not the same deal. Like, World War One is another level of brutality, death, and suffering that any modern war doesn't compare to. That's insane to me. Of like, we look at the carnage of war today, doesn't compare. Doesn't compare to history's past. We are the golds, so we need hardship. We actually need to do something like the Golds Institute.
And so to harden yourself, you said, I'm going to make a podcast.
Listen to what I say, not what I do.
You need to harden yourself, bro, and you need to get that mic out.
Do as I say, not what I do.
You just need to get on camera, get outside your comfort zone, and get hard.
A little David Goggins. Yeah. No, I mean,
who's
going to
carry
the boats?
Yeah.
But there's a lot of different factors of it. It's not just physical hardness, which, hey, physical fitness is very important. You should be fit, especially if you're young. It's much easier to build your strength young and try and keep it when you're old than build it when you're old. But, yeah, there's also mental toughness, like financial toughness is actually not just spending money on every little thing, but trying to save your money and, you know, delaying gratification. That's just the focus that we need to...
Yeah, and I don't. Maybe you're saying this as well. It's not seeking suffering. It's not actively make yourself and put yourself in harm's way. Don't make stupid decisions. But if you actively pursue good and love and all these things, suffering will come in the search and seeking all those good things. And so living a full life and being active and just pursuing will still lead you to having not a sedentary, hedonistic, gold lifestyle. So don't go out there and be like, I want to go in World War One to harden myself. That's not the message.
It's seeking good rather than fun.
Now, here's something that Pierce Brown says that maybe you would definitely disagree with. But he says, Pierce Brown says, he does not think that Hunger Games nor Ender's Game is what inspired Red Rising. Those were not the thoughts that came to his mind. Now, what do you have to say about that before he explains himself?
Ender's Game, I'll give him that.
Not give him Hunger Games.
Hunger Games, it's Hunger Games in space. That's what the book is.
Well, you want to hear his defense?
Go ahead, you can try.
Pierce Brown says, I think Frank Herbert's Dune and Alexandre Dumas's Count of Monte Cristo are the closest parallel to Red Rising in terms of tone and story. People compare it with The Hunger Games and The Maze Runner and other things like that, but I've always felt Red Rising's soul is much more in line with Alexandre Dumas and Frank Herbert. Those guys are classics, and I'm not comparing myself to them, but that's where I got a lot of the inspiration.
If he was going for tone, tone and themes, I'm not really sure that it's as connected with Dune. I can see some parallels, but purely plot, like, it's Hunger Games.
Here's why I want Pierce Brown on this podcast. Again, please let him know. We want to talk to Pierce Brown.
There's a common connection. Give it. Fine. Fair enough. Like,
first question you ask him if we get to interview him is Cap. I think you're lying. But I do want to see his response because it does interest me. Like, obviously, there's the Hunger Games aspect, and the reason he wrote Red Rising, as mentioned earlier, was people weren't accepting space operas at the time, so he was doing something more YA. Hunger Games came out in 2008.
What was the popular YA story at the time?
Yeah,
it's Hunger Games. What was the plot that happened in Red Rising? They're turned into a Hunger Games scenario, like, quite literally. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
They're very different, but same premise. I get you.
No, and it's the same premise with different undertones and what rules. It meant for.
Yeah.
No, he's right on tone. Mm-hmm. Yeah, different tone, different story that he's ultimately going for. But the setting in the first book.
It's the plot.
The plot is Hunger Games in space. So what is? I mean, there's nothing negative.
It's more so. It's more so this. Maybe not Hunger Games in space. It's more Battle Royale in space. And did Hunger Games start that? I'm not sure if it made it very popular.
It made it the most popular.
It made it most popular, but
yeah, it didn't start it
because the rules of Hunger Games and in Pierce Brown's book one are very different. And there's a lot that, for example, it's not the last one to survive. The reason for going into the games is very different. It's not the worst of society. It's actually the best of society. It's kind of flipped on its head. So for me, why ideas are inspired by that.
Well, you're going to get in trouble there. Are the golds the best of the color hierarchy? Like, oh yeah, they're the best of the society.
I mean by the best positioned in society. So
that was the same thing with the Hunger Games. The people who ran the games were the people who were most privileged in society.
Ran the game? No, the people
they ran
in,
it.
The people in the games are all the districts, and, like, you know, Katniss is from District 13. They just get launched.
I got you. Yes.
So I'm saying the people attending the games, the people that are being put in there, the kids, mm-hmm. are either they're forced to in the Hunger Games, and in Pierce Brown's Red Rising, it's the kids who have it all are put into this situation. So
gotcha.
Anyways, they're different, but of course the plot has that battle royale element, so it's going to get compared all the time. Mm-hmm. But I want to get into my favorite part here about Pierce Brown. It's his writing style and his writing routine. Because if any of you authors out there are inspired by it, you want to know what different authors do to become successful or how do they do their thing. I always like to look at people for, hey, if they're successful, let me try to take some snippets there. Because it's not a one-size-fits-all. Different writers have their thing. But how does Pierce Brown do it?
Mm-hmm. How does he?
Well, I'll tell you. His typical day as a writer, he says he tries to write 8 hours a day. He wakes up, has his breakfast, reads his paper, reads a book on poetry, nerd, particularly English. Listen to this. He's every woman's and mine dream. He says this. So first off, if you see, here's a picture of Pierce Brown. If you haven't noticed already, he's a gorgeous man. But he says, I read a book of poetry, particularly English romantics, because they have such a felicity of phrase and expression, and it really opens up my use of words. you perfect, shut up. It's just, you know what you're doing, Pierce Brown. He's using that word, like, has such a felicity of phrase and expression. If I didn't like his writing and him and he was funny and amazing, I would really, that would piss me off. And other, and if it came, if that came out of your mouth.
Yeah.
People listen. Imagine,
I don't think I've ever used the word felicity in that context.
Imagine you, Rich, saying particularly English romantics because they have such a felicity of phrase and expression.
I aspire to that level of pretentiousness.
And it's beautiful. And
I say that as a pretentious man myself.
Yeah.
I aspire to those levels. And hey, I salute you for it, Pierce.
Cheers, Pierce.
Cheers.
So, this is what he's saying. That's his writing routine. He wakes up, reads a poem. But then he writes until lunchtime and sometimes takes a break to eat lunch or go work out. He works out. Oh my God. And then I'll come back and write for 4 more hours. So, he'll try to be done by 7 or 8 o'clock because if he's not, then he's up to 4 a.m. and it throws off his next day. But this is the important part of his writing routine.
Yeah, you're right. He's either done by 7 or... it's by 4 a.m. Yeah, that makes sense. Can't go to 8. No. Either finish at 7 or 7:01. Might as well go to 4 a.m.
These are his words. This is him saying this. This isn't me assuming.
I'm just saying. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, he says this, that he tries to be done by 7 or 8. If not, he'll just keep going. And if he didn't write enough earlier in the day, if he delayed it, then his 8-hour shift will be like, okay, instead of writing then, now I still got to get my 8 hours in, and I started at 7 o'clock. You know, that's more what he's saying. But the important part of this, he says, I try to treat it like a regular job because I have this ticking clock inside me that says I should be working because I'm not really living a real life so much. It's almost like I'm followed around by this Catholic-sized guilt for not producing. So he has this internal conscious that's telling him, like, this isn't real. Like, what do you do? You don't have to actually go out and work an 8-hour day. It's you're the only purveyor, you're the only gatekeeper of how much you work. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're successful enough where you could fall into a trap that other authors have. When you get that success, you need a certain discipline to just keep writing the book.
George R. Martin
and
Patrick Rothfuss
and Scott Lynch.
Scott Lynch. I don't put Scott Lynch in the cup. But for some reason, I don't think of it as negatively. Maybe, I don't know why.
Why is that? He doesn't get talked about enough in that situation.
I think it's more of the promises kept. Like, he hasn't made any particular promises. Like, hey, I'm working on it.
Oh, George is just going like, it's coming. It's coming.
Yeah, no, there's work. Like, the fact that George R. R. Martin, like, says, oh, yeah, oh, it should be done this year. It ain't done this year. And he keeps doing that for, like, a decade. And then Patrick Rothfuss not releasing the chapter he promised and then saying, oh, yeah, it's going to be done this year.
It's like that person that comes to your house and you're like, oh, can't wait. Hey, let's see each other again. That's great. I'll see you soon.
Yeah.
Never saw them again. No, what's their name?
And what's worse is they keep calling you up, like, every so often just to say, hey, we should get together sometime.
What's your schedule looking? Oh, hold on, I gotta go. And then it's over.
So. You're more annoyed with them.
Yeah, because it's like, just say bye. Don't tease me, you know? Okay, so then what are some of Pierce Brown's writing habits and tricks? You'd like this first one, coffee.
Coffee is wonderful. It's the miracle drug.
He says this gets him in the zone, and he also wears noise-canceling headphones, and it's really traumatizing because sometimes people will walk in on him, and he's just in the zone, coffee, headphones, and then gets shaken up because he's literally has all distractions cut off. And that is probably a good way to write because you need to close distractions to actually focus on it. But you like the coffee bit?
I actually am trying to kick my caffeine addiction.
Yeah.
I love coffee. It's one of my favorite things, but it's become not just a favorite thing, but a dependent thing. So I've gone for 3 days now with zero caffeine and not as bad as I thought it would be.
Ah, yeah, it's not bad at all.
Okay. However, yesterday I did sleep 11 hours. So that's something.
What does that mean?
I don't know. I think I've just been on a caffeine high for
years. I did notice I'm not just saying that, like, past 3 days, you have been a little different.
Yeah.
Just, you've been a little bit more, you are a calm person, but you've just been more steady.
Mm.
Maybe not as spiky.
Maybe so. I don't know.
It's nice. It's a nice change of pace.
I just know that I went to sleep at like 7 p.m. last night.
That's why I said it was a nice change of pace. Yeah, I didn't see you the whole night. It was wonderful. So Pierce Brown, he is also a pantser, not a plotter at all. So he aspires to be a plotter, yet every time he fails to do that, because he supposed that in the end he finds that pantsing, despite the daily horror of being lost and confused as to where the story's going, it's much more natural with his writing style. And imagine, he imagined there's 10 great epiphanies that go into the days when you outline, and that's wonderful. There's 10, but when he writes with only a vague notion of the end, it gets him an epiphany every day, and he feels that spark every day. And it's one of the most rewarding parts as a writer for him. Mm. Now, again, so many writers are plotters, so many are pantsers. This is how he does it. Because here's a negative to him pantsing, for example, is Lightbringer. I mean, negative or positive still came out, of course, but he had two other versions of Lightbringer done. And he had to scrap it and write again because he pantsed it through. And so a plotter would look at that and kind of know the general where Lightbringer's going and then have the ending, and then they'd have to fix and edit it, of course. But Pierce Brown had to start at a different point. He started it with several at one point. He had several chapters for like the first 50 pages of the book, had to change where it was going. So that's where you can fall into that hole. If you don't like the outcome of your pantsing, you got to start from scratch.
Well, generally, that's the positive of a pantser, as for writing's sake, is the character interactions are normally more organic. The flow of the story just seems far more natural, because it is. It's characters are reacting and moving in time, and it feels natural and smooth. Yeah, yeah. But the negative is the endings. It's almost always harder to do the endings. So
right.
Stephen King, great writer that he is, he sometimes struggles where, like, I know people kind of read the story, like, where the story just ends and you're like, what? Huh? It just ended.
Like a Hitchcock film.
Yeah, it's a little strange sometimes. But, and it's the same thing with Pierce Brown, I imagine, runs into, is sometimes his endings are not as good as his story up until that point is, where he'll struggle with a place to end.
Yeah, because his biggest qualm, or his biggest challenge about writing, and again, it has a lot of positive pantsing, those, mm-hmm. but his biggest challenge is deciding, because sometimes there's 1,000 ways to go, and because he's pantsing, every turn he comes to, there's infinite options. Mm-hmm. And if you decide that beforehand, then you know the direction, you know where you're leading. But if he has a general vague idea, he can go 1,000 different directions to still get where he wants to go. And that's the tough part, because what interests him in that day? You could be Taravangian. Like, some days you're stupid, some days you're smart. We're all human.
Yeah, I appreciate that you think some days I'm smart.
So that is the challenging part. But the positives of being a pantser are, you're a machine. Things seem so, they flow so well. It makes that plot
much faster,
just,
writers.
Yeah.
Much faster.
Faster writer, and you generally cut the fluff because you're not expanding this portion that doesn't need to be expanded. It's just tension is high, and it really works with Red Rising.
Well, there's a difference of when you're looking, when you're doing that top-down view of a story and you're trying to plan out the whole thing.
Yeah.
You think certain things are necessary because you want to get to a certain spot. But then when you actually get down to writing it, like, you actually don't need that section, but you don't know that you don't need it because you're following the plan.
Mm.
And that's the problem. That's how I kind of see it. That's where the fluff can come in, where if you're a pantser, yeah, you're just writing what's necessary to get you to the next scene.
Right.
That's it. Maybe you have to, like, when you're done, you're like, oh, I got to add in another scene, or I'm going to write this and add a chapter in.
Right.
But it's not the same. Normally, the planner has to cut it down.
Significantly, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that is his writing style and stuff. So next
what, subject. What would you consider yourself? Now that you're writing your book.
Oh, yeah. It's a pantser that wants to be a plotter. Very similar. And so it's I'm a failed pantser who has to plot.
Ah.
That's who I am.
How have you run into that? Why do you say a failed pantser?
Because I have the same struggle of me, like, you know, me, little old me who's going to give writing advice.
Well, hey, there are people out there who have not written anything, and they want to know, like,
Oh, yeah. Don't kind of okay, beginner. Here's what not to do if you're just starting, right?
Ah, yeah. So we could give plenty of that advice.
Yeah. I wrote a ton of chapter ones. I got further than that. I would get to chapter 20s or chapter 10s and then just realize this isn't where I wanted to go because of this. And I'd go back and have to change a fundamental point of the story. So for me, it was I would love the pantsing. It would always feel organic and I love the character interactions. But same problem where the deciding portion of the thousand different ways to go, I have to figure that out beforehand or else I run into a wall where I'm like, this isn't where it's supposed to go. Because I went the natural way, but the natural way isn't telling a good story. That's just me though, because I'll read it and then, yeah, that's really it. It's just I can't pants because I go, oh, there's a better idea that I should have thought through.
Fair that's enough.
It. People can probably relate to that of if you've tried, you ever sit down and just try to write a first chapter or you try to get into writing and then you lose the steam for some reason. So my fear was that plotting out the book would lose my steam and go, then where's the discovery? Where's the joy? That's, and that's
currently what I've run into. I've planned out like properly two stories.
Yeah.
But once I figured out the whole story, I just became really less enthused about it. And I was like, yeah, okay. Now I'm not. And so I'm trying something a little different where I'm just coming up with characters and that's
seeing where it goes, right?
And I'll just pants it.
That's the way to, again, there's no right answer to plotting or pantsing. I think I need to try to find an in-between.
Maybe like the goalposts, like,
yeah.
Yeah, I think I want to hit this and this in the story. However they get there, we'll find out, but
that's how I'm approaching this now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that makes it a lot more fun because if everything's written out, so Harry Potter and J.K. Rowling, she had that down.
Yeah,
and sometimes you need to, but she was still able to write and have the passion for it. So my fear of losing that drive to write on for plotting is something I hope I don't run into. But that's enough of that. Back to Pierce Brown and some adaptation history and news with what's going on there. So Red Rising is currently not adapted. It went to Universal and it was supposed to be a film in back 2016 if everything went well. But it went through development hell and Pierce Brown ended up getting the rights back because nothing ended up happening with it. So right now, Pierce, he's not revealing who, but it is currently with a streamer. With a streamer. There's some conversation there. Don't know exactly what, and he can't say who. And they're taking their time with it. And this is why I want to show a clip here. This is why I have faith in the Red Rising adaptation, where I'm also hoping it's animated. That's another side thing. But this is what Pierce Brown said about the adaptation itself. Here, take it away, Pierce.
That it's not good. It's slow in getting made because I think it's getting made the right way. With all this stuff, it's a crapshoot. You hope it turns out good.
You don't want to rush really it. Do. Yeah, you want to get it right the first time.
And assemble the right players, the right people, the people who think like that love it for the same reasons you do and really understand the tone and the feeling of it. And they're not just doing it because they think it's going to be big or because they want to put their own spin on it. I think that that's often been the problem with quite a few adaptations. I mean, when Peter Jackson was making Lord of the Rings, he said that he didn't think it was his job to put any of his opinions or political views into Lord of the Rings. His job was to tell if J.R.R. Tolkien's political opinions and views in Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. And I thought that to be extremely admirable, and I think that's something that is very lacking often in adaptation.
Yes! More of that! That is exactly how I view adaptations. It's just, how did the author... This is the author's story. You are the shepherd. You are the steward of this story. You are not writing this. If you're going to use that IP, if you're using the name of that author, tell the story they were telling. Or just write something different. Like, do it. Hey, do a cool spin on it and make your own thing if you want to do your own thing. But you're writing their story.
You know, it's a funny twist of things. So I promise this is relating back to it. But
I can't wait to hear this.
Star Trek. Okay. I'm a big Star Trek nerd. Mm-hmm. I love it. It's one of my favorite things. One of the saddest things is how the official IP has gone down and I believe has lost the soul of what Star Trek really is. Mm. At its heart, Star Trek is normally a pretty hopeful look in the future. It's a futuristic, it's a utopian series and normally has very positive messages and really complex, interesting stuff. Wonderful. They've run that off a cliff. It's pessimistic, negative. It's often just teaches terrible messages of actually how to, like, terrible wisdom.
Damn.
However, the Orville is a spin-off knockoff parody of Star Trek, mm-hmm, by the guy who does Family Guy.
Okay.
And so he was able to do it. Like, it's not Star Trek, but it's clearly Star Trek. Mm. So it is a spinoff, and it more closely captures the heart and soul of what Star Trek is. Yes, it is still a comedy. It is still, like, very much a parody. It still has those parody elements, but it carries the real soul of Star Trek, not the official IP.
It seems like it was made by an actual fan.
Yeah.
They were able to parody it enough because they understood the material enough.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, I just find that interesting of the medium can change, and you do have to change things for the medium, depending on it.
Of course.
But you do have to capture the soul, the message. What is the original source trying to get at?
Yep.
And hopefully Pierce Brown has enough money to, you know, resist the publishing house, not publishing house, but the producers and all that, to
change things,
to hold on to the rights, right? Because Oda, the creator of One Piece, in the contract with Netflix, he had full creative licensing control of, if he didn't like it, it was a no, and he could can the whole project at any point. Like, if Netflix came to, like, hey, we finished it, it's done, and he says no.
But Rich, the democracy of people who wanted to write the story differently said, Oda, this is how you should do it. They said, Oda, what is that, Rich?
Democracy is cringe.
So, again, this is their story. And what Pierce Brown's saying about Lord of the Rings and what Peter Jackson did, okay, no, he didn't have Tom Bombadil, he didn't have this. It's even a bit of a different story in some ways, of emphasizing the battles a bit. There's different things, but it captured the heart. It kept the same messages. It kept you in the tone of Middle Earth and gave that a perfect visual medium for what the books are. And they are different things.
Oh, no. In tone, the, like, Peter Jackson captured the heart and I think the tone. However, in the vehicle for the story being told, the setting, the plot, in many ways, I think Peter Jackson did the opposite of what Tolkien was trying to do. Because Tolkien was telling a story where all the battles were a paragraph long, where in Peter Jackson's films, it's the centerpiece.
Right, the battles were big, yeah.
And so it's kind of an inversion of the books, but you still got the core message there. So that's why he did really well.
It's why Christopher Tolkien's kid did not like the adaptation, because it took away those elements, which, hey, I love the movies, but I understand why the son was disappointed, because he grew up hearing his father read the story to him. He went on and continued to finish the Silmarillion. It's his heart and soul. This is his father he looks up to, and he goes, you have this vision in your head, especially as a kid, and especially as this is your whole thing, of what this work is.
Well, he's also right to, when his criticism of it was, Peter Jackson turned The Lord of the Rings into an action movie. And yeah, an action adventure. That is right. He did do that. It's a great action adventure, but the books aren't that. It very much is the opposite of it. It doesn't go into those directions. It's a exploration of the world through stories and myths and legends, and it's a long epic journey.
Right. It's definitely, what about the question here of, do you think if J.R.R. Tolkien was alive today, would he look at the adaptations and be proud and happy with them, or would he be disappointed?
I bet he wouldn't talk too much about it, but I bet he wouldn't like it as much. He was notoriously picky about his works. He's a stickler for his details, and he likes it exactly the way he does.
He did sell the rights, though, for, I believe it was £100,000 when he was alive. So he did sell the rights.
I could be wrong, but just seeing his letters on how he was very particular on how stuff is sold, for translations, on how he didn't want the Polish version giving more Polish names to fictional things, that he was very particular on, no, I made up this language. It's going to be, you're going to say it right. All the little details. So I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't like it. But just like with his friend, you know, C.S. Lewis, he knows when to keep his mouth shut.
And to go back to the movies for a second, yes, that made the battles longer, made it to an action adventure. But the important point is that Peter Jackson did a couple things. He didn't take away the message and the soul of the story, as in, you know why we still love it and it has that connection. If it was just action adventure, it would not hold up. You still have the moments with Gandalf. Like, all we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to us. It's the pity of Bilbo that kept it. And all these moments that are still heartfelt and touching and still capture the soul and essence of what Lord of the Rings is apparent, and it's there. It's more mm-hmm. and it's grander and it's this epic film. But it's still that there's no arguing that when Peter Jackson was making this film, he was thinking about Tolkien all the time and trying to adapt into a different medium. And I think it's the right decision, even with the grander battles in many of the cases of...
Well, it's a visual medium.
Exactly. Adapting that into there and then having like this build up in three acts of three movies. And what you're leading up to is, hey, book two, it ends at this Helm's Deep moment. So it's kind of got to be a big deal and what they're leading up to. So it's telling the story in this different medium perfectly for me. So
I agree.
Pierce Brown, he has this adaptation. We don't know what streamer it has and what streaming service has it right now. But a big part of me really does hope it is animated.
That Why would be do you freaking think so?
Sick. Just because the visuals would be so cool, kind of like an Arcane style, something along those lines, where the different colors and the cast system and how I envision everything in my mind isn't as easy to do in live action, I guess.
See, I would disagree. I think this could be handled in live action pretty darn well.
Oh, good, yeah. I'm just saying
of the other things. So, like, give you a back and forth on this one. Mm-hmm. Do you think Red Rising or Stormlight is better suited for animation?
Ooh, which is better for animation?
Yeah, so like if you think Red Rising needs to be animated, what are you thinking about Stormlight? Should Stormlight live action?
Well, to clarify, I'm happy with either live or animated.
Of course.
I'm just kind of on the animation train of we haven't seen too many sci-fis. A lot of them are live action. You have Rings of Power, Wheel of Time, Witcher, all these things. And Red Rising is like sci-fi fantasy. You know, it's not really... And hey, Expanse... all of them are live action, and something about Arcane, something about the animation side, I just want to see something different. And sure. Maybe I'm also associating with the failed projects in the past that some of them I just referred to, Witcher even, where they didn't do a good job. Maybe animating will lead to a little bit more creative freedom, or you can do, there's obviously things you can do with animation that you can't do in live action. That's what makes it cool, and the visuals really sick. Again, live action will be cool. Love it, too. Stormlight, I'd also like that. I haven't thought about it too much, but I'd like both.
Yeah, personally, I think animation is... It has some of the most potential of any medium, any visual medium, that the possibilities are endless. It is harder to do than live action, I think. Like, or harder is the wrong word. I think longer... It's a longer process. Just trying to animate a single scene is incredibly arduous, especially if you have a director that's like trying to redo things. So painful process. However, it being a painful process generally means there's not a lot of wiggle room. You have to get it right when you're directing it. I want this exact scene. I know exactly how it's going to go and where the characters are moving. You can't do this kind of wishy-washy, like, let's just kind of throw the characters on scene and let's go nuts. So maybe that's a positive for animation.
I'm not beholden to this. I just would like to see it where I maybe a little bit my nerves with the live action are just coming, hey, I think because of the similarities between Red Rising and Game of Thrones killing off characters, they might try to make it too melodramatic or dramatic in the way of, oh, look at these deaths, and trying to make it something that it's not. Because a lot of things are trying to try to improperly emulate Game of Thrones when, no, that's a very different story. Mm-hmm. So maybe some of my nerves are coming in there.
Fair enough.
But you'd be happy with that? You'd watch the show with me, right?
Of course.
You'd have a great time. It'd be so fun.
Oh, no. If the show comes on, we have to watch it. That's like our thing.
Oh, that's the entire couple months of our channel.
Yeah, exactly.
I just want to end this with what Pierce Brown is currently up to. And so he is writing the seventh and last book of the Red Rising saga called Red God. And this is, he's done with Red Rising after this. He does not plan to go back to the world of Red Rising. Hey, something could happen in the future, but he's done. This has been an 11-year journey. So what he said, he's been having ideas brewing for the past 8 years. And the next book he wants to write is fantasy. A fantasy book. Now, he says he doesn't want to commit to another 11-year long journey, so he'd like to write a standalone or like maybe a start to a trilogy or start to a series, but really he just wants to write a fantasy. He has two ideas, a high fantasy, and he has an idea for a low fantasy, low to mid fantasy. And I would love to see his writing style and his kind of plot and pace in a fantasy world.
I want to see his high fantasy.
Yeah. That,
just particularly, it'd be very different from what he's normally does.
Imagine so, Stormlight, but fast-paced.
Yeesh.
Right?
Yeah, I know. Oh, Lord. Yeah.
I'm so curious. I'm buying that book immediately.
Do you want him to write a multi-POV story or a single POV story?
Multi.
You want him to have the multi?
I do, yeah.
Okay.
I want it because I want to see something. So I think he's also developed as a writer from where it's easier, in quotes, to write a single point of view.
He had Iron Gold, and he worked out most of the kinks after that.
Yeah, because after the first trilogy in Red Rising, just Darrow, then you get... I think he has the writing experience now to go multi-point of view and make something epic and grand. And I'd love to see what he can do with a fantasy world.
Yeah, I agree.
Ugh. It's exciting. Rich, do you want to sign us off with a quick fun fact about Pierce Brown?
We got to meet him. Here's a picture of us. We took a picture together. Bye,
everybody.
He knows us.
See you next week.
Bye.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.